Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. Chuck Moore speaks here at Blog Talk Radio. Thanks for joining me. We are waiting for my guest, Peter Palermo. He is the editor of VDare.com, America's foremost authority. He is one of America's foremost authority on issues of immigration. He's often been referred to as a major leader of the alt-right movement. Although his expertise on the issue of immigration, national identity, and political correctness long precedes both the term and the movement, this came to my attention mainly because a couple of weeks back, Democratic presidential nominee Hillary Clinton delivered a speech where she attempted to smear Donald Trump by associating him with this alt-right movement that I had never heard of, and that really the first time I'd heard of it was from Hillary's speech, which I found quite infuriating. You know, it reminds me of what Senator Joe McCarthy was accused of doing. You know, so-and-so was seen, you know, in the room at a hotel with a communist in 1951. Aha, you know, and then they get a picture, you know. And, you know, that somehow this is an association. And that's putting aside what the alt-right movement actually is. Apparently it is a real movement, and I want to hear about that from one of the leaders of that movement, Peter Brimelow, who is the author of many books. I interviewed Peter years ago on his book on education. And he's a British immigrant to the United States via Canada. He knows something about immigration, and he talks about the potential deleterious effects of immigration on American culture and American and our American ethos and way of life, and does so with a good deal of bluntness, at least from what I've heard in the past. You know, we'll await his arrival. He should be here any minute. If not, then I'm going to have him back because I'd like to do this one. This is, to me, pretty interesting. Let me just see what's going on here. I don't know what's going on, but anyway, I shall forge forward either way. The alt-right movement, it's, you know, I'm kind of at a loss for words because I really don't know anything about it. My suspicion is that it falls under the category of a comment that I heard Ann Coulter make about Peter Brimelow, and she cited him, where he said that the racist of today, as it is defined, is really a conservative who beats a liberal in an argument. I think that there's some truth to that. That's not to say that there isn't real racism, of course. There certainly is. But, you know, when we're looking at, you know, today's day and age when racism in the real sense has receded, and when you have the black community in growing numbers entering the middle class, the upper middle class, the wealthy, you know, the working world, and in spite of leftist policies and ideas, you have to ask yourself what's going on when the left continues to use this as a bludgeon, and that this idea that someone can be not only called a racist, as is the case with Donald Trump, but called it in such a way that it is assumed that it's true. Of course he's racist. You know, you hear people in positions of responsibility saying this, when in fact it's obviously, on face value, a complete lie. There is no evidence that Donald Trump has anything against black men and women or any other group based on their ethnicity. I mean, you could look at his businesses over the past 30 or 40 years. Is there evidence that he's ever not promoted someone because they're black? Or he's not hired someone because they're black? No. In fact, Trump is the least racist person that I've seen come down the pike in a long time. He doesn't seem to care at all about a person's race. He's more interested in whether or not a person is successful, and that's who he promotes. So, okay, we are joined by Peter Brimelow. Peter, thank you for joining me this afternoon. Hello, Peter, are you there? All right, speak up, Peter, when you're able. There we go. Let me just see if I can. I might be doing something wrong with the switchboard here. If so, call up or speak up. Maybe call back and we'll try it that way. Again, Peter Brimelow is the editor of BeDare.com, America's foremost authority on issues of immigration, often referred to as a major leader of the alt-right movement. Let's see if I can click something here and make it happen. Peter, if you're listening, I'm going to ask you to call back, and we'll see if I can do it the old-fashioned way. And I think that he is now trying to call in, so that's good news. Here at Blog Talk Radio, where we do this thing essentially online. This isn't the old-fashioned stick when the radio waves, it goes out off the airwaves. Back, I mean, this is a bludgeon. It's a weapon that's in the hands of the left when they put someone under the microscope and insist that they find a racist cell, with real racism, Jim Crow, discrimination out of the way. That's sort of what they've resorted to. Peter, are you there? Thanks for joining me. Hello, Peter. Come in. I see that you're trying to call. I don't know why I can't hear you. But speak up. Here we go. Hello, Peter.
Can you hear me?
Yes,
there
we go. Thank you so much for joining me. Great. Appreciate you being on, Peter. Not at all. You came to my attention, Peter, mainly because I had heard Hillary Clinton's comments in a speech about the alt-right movement, which is something that I had not heard of. And then I also heard Ann Coulter mention, quote you, and with attribution, when she said that she heard you define racism as essentially when a conservative wins an argument with a liberal, which I thought was a pretty good quotation.
Country Club Republican.
There we go. But let me just start out by your introducing this idea of what is this alt-right? I had never heard of it until now.
Well, Chuck, there's always been what we call FIDER.com, which is my website, a dissident right. There's always been people in opposition to the Republican establishment. And that goes all the way back to Goldwater. And most notably, of course, Pat Buchanan in the 90s. Well, what's different about the alt-right, which is kind of a subset of this phenomenon of people being opposed to the Republican establishment, is that it's predominantly a movement of very young people. They use, quite astonishing techniques. It's certainly astonishing to me as a long-time print journalist and so on. It's a heavily internet-based movement. They use memes and Twitter and all these things, which I have a lot of trouble getting my head around. And it had a different tone. It's very much a young man's movement. It's extremely, harsh humor and extremely politically incorrect. It takes joy in being politically incorrect. So I run my website, VDare.com, is focused entirely on the immigration issue. It's a forum site. We'll take people from any part of the political spectrum if they have something critical to say about what we regard as the post-1965 immigration disaster. So I have a number of people on my site, writers, who are actually really prominent alt-right writers, James Kirkpatrick, Washington Watcher, Alexander Hart, and so on. And so that's why VDare is often viewed as an alt-right site. One, it's in opposition to the Republican establishment, the conservative establishment. And two, it features a lot of these younger people. And three, I guess, the immigration issue itself is very central to the whole alt-right phenomenon. They're very much aware of the demographic displacement that's going on through public policy at the moment, and of course will be enormously increased if Hillary is actually elected.
Now, what is just to give some historic context here, you made reference to the immigration disaster of 1965, which I think was Ted Kennedy's immigration reform. What exactly, I've heard that made referred to occasionally. What exactly happened there? What was in that that changed the way we our immigration policy in the United States?
Well, you know, in 1965, there's been a period of, in U.S. history of over 40 years when there was very little immigration. In fact, in the 40s, there was actually net negative immigration. That's because immigration was cut off. There was a great surge of immigration in the 1880s through the 1920s, and it was cut off. So, and by and large, Americans were very happy with that. What Kennedy said he was going to do was make very minor changes because the legislation of the 20s was based on national origins. It tried to have people coming in to the extent that they did come in who were the same sorts of people who came into the U.S. in the past. And he said this was discrimination because, of course, you couldn't come in from Asia or Africa, places which had made no historic contribution to the U.S. And so he was going to make slight changes to allow these people to come in. But in fact, what the bill did was, in small numbers, and he specifically said that this bill will not we won't have 1 million immigrants a year, and we will not be shifting the ethnic balance of the country. But of course, all this actually happened. The bill, whether either deliberately or accidentally, triggered an enormous flood of legal immigration from not complete, while choking it off from traditional areas that from which American immigrants had come, for example, most of Europe. European immigration, and for that matter, Canadian immigration, was dramatically reduced. And immigration began from completely new areas of the world. And essentially, the Hispanic minority in the U.S. has been essentially developed by public policy since 1965, for example. But mm-hmm. The funny thing was, at the same time, the executive branch simply stopped enforcing the law against legal immigration. And that mm-hmm. triggered a great surge, against illegal immigration. And that triggered a great surge of illegal immigration. So the two proceeded in parallel. And the result is that whereas America was 90% white in 1960, it's now below 70% white, and whites will go into a minority somewhere in the next 15 years. And that's entirely a result of public policy. It's, you know, to quote the first famous saying, the government is dissolving the people and electing a new one. And the alt-right doesn't like this.
Well,
President Obama was
attending the Asian summit, he actually said in the speech that America would be a majority non-white country in the next, I think, maybe 15 years or so.
Somewhere about 24.
From my perspective, I mean, I don't know if I have a problem with that on the surface. I'm more interested in whether or not the new immigrants are properly assimilating into American culture, whether or not they arrive here with the economic means to not become dependent on welfare. You know, in the 1940s, for example, you say there was practically no immigration, and yet the Roosevelt administration denied the opportunity for Jews to immigrate to the United States from Nazi Germany, and that these were people, including my own heritage, who were able economically to support themselves, or they had people who sponsored them, who were willing to take responsibility for them for a number of years so that they would not become burdens on the state. They were, you know, yes, self-sufficient, and that they were wanting very much to assimilate into American culture. It wasn't in any way, there was nothing about them. It's not similar to some of the more recent Islamic immigrants who have a separatist tendency. Rather than assimilating into American culture, they want American culture to conform to them. So I'm not sure. It's not really a matter of being against immigration. It's more whether or not the immigrant groups are assimilating, whether they're contributing, and whether or not they are financially self-sufficient.
Well, you know, all of that was changed by the 65 Act. For the first time in American history, because of the way the Act worked, the immigrant in was on average less skilled than the American host population. Typically, throughout most of American history, immigrants have been more skilled, but these were less skilled. And they also are massively into public charge. They're heavily into transfer payments of all types. Milton Friedman once said to me, I used to interview him every year at one point for Forbes magazine, and he said, you know, you can have mass immigration and you can have a welfare state, but you can't have both together. Because what's happened with the welfare state, and it's not just welfare, by the way, it's transfer payments of all types, including public education. In the 1880s through 1920s, if they failed in the workforce, they would typically go home. And in fact, net immigration was only a fraction of gross immigration in those days, because vast numbers of people did go home, particularly some groups as high as 90%. Italians, a very large number of Italians ultimately ended up going home. But that's not the case now, because if people fail in the workforce, they can stay on welfare. They can stay on
exactly.
And also the children.
To me, that
the
should
children,
be the emphasis.
The other thing that people don't realize is, you know, they often say, well, illegal immigrants can't get welfare. The answer is that their American-born children get welfare, and the parents get to spend it for them. So every incentive to stay is completely – the incentives in the immigration system are extremely perverse, and it's producing, you know, more dependent populations. And the Democrats love this, because one marked thing about the 1965 Immigration Act is that it is importing Democrats at a very fast rate. These are the new groups. Vote overwhelmingly Democrat. And the Democrats openly say that they intend to go on with this immigration policy until they've achieved a permanent majority.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the thing that really, you know, gets me hot under the collar on the issue is the fact that part of the new immigration policy got rid of the charge system. It got rid of this idea that a person would have to demonstrate, if they wanted to become an American citizen, that they would be a burden on the state, that they actually had sponsors, and that I think that that system was much more humane certainly to the taxpayer, and that it also required the citizen, the new citizen, to show some kind of responsibility that should be part of any citizenship to this country, instead of becoming a part of the welfare system, which, to my way of thinking, it's just inexplicable to me how anyone could support that. Why a working person in this country should hand over a portion of their hard-earned money that would otherwise go to their family to support someone who is a foreigner coming into this country just because they're here, because they want it.
The amazing thing is that a lot of these public charge laws are still on the books. The executive branch simply ceased to enforce them. You're quite right. It absolutely enrages people when they realize what's happening. And that's why the Democrats and the left in general are so eager to just keep constantly yelling racist, 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 because they know that if people realize what's happening to them, they become incredibly angry. And, of course, that's really what's fueled Trump. He picked up this issue when none of the professional politicians would pick it up.
Well, this election, I mean, Donald Trump is bringing up issues that I never thought I'd see brought up by a major candidate in my lifetime. And those issues, I think the thing that is particularly galling to the establishment, both the Democrats and the Republican establishment, is the fact that he is calling for an assertion of national sovereignty and all of the things that are incumbent on that, including protecting who comes into our national home. You know, just like we as individuals have the natural right to protect who determine who comes into our own homes, you know, if you go into my home and I don't want you there, you have to leave. And if you don't leave, that's a crime. You know, it's breaking and entering. We expect our national government, which represents us, to protect the national home. And it's something that makes such basic common sense, and yet neither party or no major politician has had the moral courage or the practical common sense to bring this up until Donald Trump. And that's what is boiling their blood, I think.
I agree. They basically, there was a sort of bipartisan globalist consensus, and Trump has broken it. You know, there's a lot of whittering about whether Trump is a conservative or not. But as he said in the debate in New Hampshire, you know, conservatism to him means conserving the country. He's a nationalist. He's an American nationalist. And of course,
exactly.
That's apparently a very bad thing to be. I was astonished. It was amazing to watch when he brought up the idea of possibly not, you know, having a moratorium on Muslim immigration until we figure out what's going on. All kinds of Republicans and Democrats were making serious arguments that, well, no, it's in the Constitution that we can't discriminate against any religious group. Of course, the Americans have absolute right to bar any group that they want from coming to
country. Of course.
There's nothing in the Constitution
about
that.
Not only do we have a right to do it, but it's...
I'm sorry?
I mean, not only do we have a right to do it, but it's actually been an assumed power of the executive to do it, going all the way back to, Jimmy Carter did it. I mean, you know, this goes back. I mean, it goes back to Truman. It goes back to Teddy Roosevelt. I mean, this isn't anything new. And this idea
the only thing that's in the Constitution bearing on immigration is that the Washington is supposed to protect the several states against invasion. And actually, California at one point sued the federal government because it said the federal government was not enforcing the law at the border. But the judges threw it out, of course, because they didn't want. You know, you can't rely on judges to uphold the law anymore in this country. You can't.
More recently, Arizona basically reasserted national law, not made law, but they simply said we're going to enforce the national law with regard to immigration by insisting that immigrants have identification on them. And that was turned into they were being like Nazis or something, when in fact it's been the law of the land going all the way back, I think, to the Nazis. The immigrants have to have identification. There's nothing new.
Yes, that's right. When I first came here, we were supposed to have our green card with us at all times. And that was unilaterally dropped by the Carter administration. We just suddenly stopped getting these. You used to have to register every year. And it used to get postcards reminding you to register, and they suddenly stopped during the Carter years.
Right. Oh, okay. So then already it was the whole system was being weakened, even then. And then of course in the 1990s, the Congressman Barney Frank got through Congress several new laws that forbid the government from even looking into someone's terrorist background if they came into the United States.
The utter hypocrisy of the Obama administration's attack on Arizona is shown by there's several hundred so-called sanctuary cities in this country where the local government is directed not to cooperate with the immigration authorities. The most famous case in this campaign is in California, where that poor girl, Kay Stanley, was killed by somebody who illegal immigrant who had been deported several times. And he'd gone to San Francisco specifically because he knew he wouldn't be asked about his legal status if he committed a crime. Now, that's clearly in violation of federal law, but they've made no attempt to suppress it. And they're not suing San Francisco or any of these sanctuary cities. And the reason is that the Democrats openly want to elect new people here. They want to have as many third world immigrants as possible because they're convinced they will vote Democratic. And
it comes down to just their power. They're not interested in the actual welfare of our nation, of our labor, for that matter.
Yeah.
I mean, what about American labor? You know, American labor unions have worked for centuries trying to improve the conditions of American workers. That's all out the window. I mean, even Bernie Sanders, who was a virtual communist, understood this. And he opposed open borders for that reason. I mean, this is a basic of any sovereign nation.
It. And of course, traditionally, the labor unions opposed it, and the labor unions were instrumental in orchestrating the last big cut up in the 1920s. But the problem now is that, first of all, the American labor movement is in terrible shape, and most of the most powerful unions are public employee unions. And they tend to be very, very left wing, and they're interested in expansion of government. So they see illegal aliens as clients rather than the problem, rather than the threat. And the second problem, you know, is that these labor unions, they're basically run by full time leftist bureaucrats who really have nothing in common with the actual members. I would say the same is true, by the way, about the environmentalist organizations. I mean, at VDare.com, we get email all the time from people saying, you know, what's the point of having environmental regulations if we're going to drive the population up by another 100 million by 2050? And there just simply isn't going to be. The pressure on the environment is due to population growth, and population growth is due to immigration. But the leadership of the environmentalist organizations simply will not address the question. In fact, they fought very hard to the Sierra Club has a balloting system, and they fought very hard to suppress an insurgency a few years ago where people were trying to get the Sierra Club to go back to its original position to immigration. It turned out that the Sierra Club had a major donor who threatened to withdraw his donation if the Sierra Club came out against immigration. Grassroots environmentalists, so to speak, they're acutely aware of the problem of immigration, but the labor, the big bureaucrats who run these environmentalist organizations don't want to know about it.
Well, you know, it's all follow the money. I mean, these groups are willing to sell out, you know, labor unions are selling out the interests of workers, environmental groups are selling out the environment, women's groups, you know,
yes.
sell out women
and, you know,
when they say nothing about...
Right, and Coulter made a very interesting point about Trump and his rivals in the primaries. She said that some of them showed signs of wanting to compete with on the illegal immigration issue. For example, Scott Walker from Wisconsin actually said he agreed with Trump about how there shouldn't be birthright citizenship. At the moment, an illegal alien who comes in as a child, that child is technically an American citizen. And that makes them, as a practical matter, very difficult to deport. And most common law jurisdictions have changed their law because of this problem. Anyway, Scott Walker said he was in favor, and then he suddenly announced he changed his mind again. He'd gone back to being against any attempt to deal with birthright citizenship because he had a major donor in Wisconsin who is apparently, completely boneheaded on this issue. And is one of these very wealthy people who wants lots of cheap labor.
That's one of the
people,
amazing things.
The donors
about,
wouldn't let the other candidates respond to Trump. He had this issue all to himself.
I mean, that's one of the amazing things about Trump. He's not beholden to these donors because he's self-financed. They can't control him, and I think it's absolutely driving them nuts. And I mean, the irony is, I keep getting these emails from this group that wants to end Citizens United, and they're just viciously attacking Trump. When he's the only one that isn't taking donations from multinational corporations, and whereas Hillary is a creature of that. I mean, she is Wall Street.
Right. That's right. I mean, the Trump is revolutionary in another way as well, Chuck, as you know, which is that he's running a very, very cheap campaign here. I mean, you know,
of course.
If you think about it, Bush and Rubio and Cruz all spent over $100 million in the primary, all of them. And Trump spent about $30 million. The reason he was able to do that is he had ideas. They don't have ideas; they just have television ads.
Oh, I know it. I mean, he speaks plainly. You know, he actually has. They say now, well, he's not being consistent. He's been extremely consistent by political standards. Where is he standing up for America First? And the other thing is that he doesn't speak with this phony British accent. I mean, you know, like the,
right,
you know,
right,
with these
right.
guys, you know, with their sophistries and their indirections and their euphemisms and their, you know,
right.
their Trump speaks plain American. He just lays
he's
it out.
He's an interesting figure, Trump. He's a really interesting figure because what he really is a blue collar billionaire. And if you look at his background, you see everybody thinks he's a New Yorker, and Ted Cruz attacks him for having New York vows and so on. But I don't know how well you know New York. Chuck, but he's from the outer boroughs.
Sure.
You know, he's not from Manhattan.
Yeah,
he's from these outer boroughs, Queens and Brooklyn and so on, where it's Archie Bunker land, and that's how
sure.
it behaves. And that's
why,
frankly,
he's street smart, and he knows how to. He doesn't need to. He's not beholden to any of these people, and he's. It's really a force of nature. I mean, I never thought I'd see anything quite like it. To me, it'll be a miracle if he wins because the array of the people that are arrayed against him are the international establishment, you know, Eastern Seaboard types, and they don't take prisoners. I mean, it's just it's an extraordinary thing to see. And again,
the
main
most amazing,
crux of his message is national sovereignty.
Right. And of course, that's also, of course, why it's resonating internationally, because you have very, very similar problems throughout the First World. And that's, of course, why they were so upset when the British voted to leave the European Union. That's not at all.
Oh, yes.
People into Davos.
And, you know, that could happen here, because the Brexit was predicted right up to the final day as being something that was just a bunch of cranks and a bunch of racists. Nobody's going to do this. And yet they woke up the next morning and it happened. I mean, I see that as the same dynamic at play here. In fact, Nigel Farage was here speaking for Trump in Texas. So, and he's an interesting figure. He left the minute it passed, he retired. He said, I've done my thing. I'm not going to take any abuse. I've done it and I'm moving on. I mean, it comes down to that. You need one or two people who are willing to step into the breach and go up on the bat, take a swing. And,
I never seen anything like it. Farage said an interesting thing when he spoke for Trump. He said, he didn't want to get involved in American political campaigns. But on the other hand, Obama came along and got involved in the Brexit vote. He went to Britain and made a speech saying that Britain would go to back of the queue if Britain voted to leave the European Union. So, from Farage's point of view, turnaround is fair play, I mean, that's why he's allowed to come and say what he thinks about American elections. And that speaks to the sort of globalist consensus, Why would the American president go over to Britain and tell them not to leave the European Union? What's that, what's it got to do with Americans, even if it was a reasonable point of view, which it wasn't?
Not only that, but Obama went to Britain and he was extremely insulting toward people who wanted to exit the union. He was meddling in the internal affairs of a foreign country. Tried to do the same thing in the state of Israel, by the way. I mean, monies went in to try to defeat Netanyahu and help their guy. And they brought the Labor Party over to the United States and they were training them in political tactics. I mean, this is how the globalists are working here. They don't like to see a leader who asserts the interests of his own nation as a foremost factor. So,
it's very interesting Trump seems to have quite a lot of support in Israel. And I saw a report in the New York Times today.
Absolutely.
It was horrified to find that they'd gone out to Brighton Beach. And they've gone to these various retirement homes or somewhere. There are a lot of Russian Jews, Jews who come over from Russia. And therefore, tremendously favored Trump,
he's going to peel off. It's amazing. I think he's going to peel off a couple of percentages of my fellow Jews, even though most of them are just brain dead. I mean, they have no idea they've been voting for Democrats since Roosevelt, and they don't think about it. They just sort of, it's a cultural thing. I'm speaking here of people in my own family. It's just they're not conscious. They're not aware of what they're doing or what they're saying. It's all just like they're defending some kind of a status quo that gives them this vague sense of comfort when they're not taking a look at the greater consequences and the fact that elections and governments are dynamic forces. They're not static. There are things that and they do have an impact on our society and our culture. So,
of course, it's particularly interesting because Trump, his daughter is Jewish and she's Orthodox, I believe. She converted. And his chief speechwriter on the immigration issue, Steve Miller, who used to work for Senator Sessions, is Jewish. So, but that still doesn't seem to be doing him. It doesn't seem to be reassuring anybody.
I think he's going to get vote.
Here you have a Republican presidential candidate giving an acceptance speech at the nominating convention in which he attacks big business. Now, when have you ever heard of that before?
It was extraordinary. I have never heard an acceptance speech like it. He doesn't give a damn what anyone thinks of him. He doesn't care, Democrat, Republican. It's very American. He speaks his mind.
Yeah.
He's not beholden to anyone. He said things that were extremely controversial by today's standards, but shouldn't be. These are things that should be seen as normal by most people. You and I would be in that crowd. like let's assert our what's best for our country first. I mean, how shocking is that?
Right.
He
gave this wonderful speech on immigration a couple of weeks ago. And he said, you know, the principle of immigration policy should be, does it benefit Americans? And this apparently is controversial.
It's
self-evident. Any normal person, it's self-evident.
Exactly. It is self-evident. And it's common sense and it's humane. I mean, people need to realize that national sovereignty is a progressive idea. It's something that didn't just happen overnight. It's evolved over millennia. This idea that a people can assert their rights within their borders and have a certain amount of control over their own lives and their own destinies as a people. I mean, these are not things that just appear out of nowhere. They have to be reasserted every generation. Every election should be an honest and vigorous rendering of what is the state of our national sovereignty.
I think national sovereignty and the nation state, you know, they're as fundamental to democracy as property rights are to a functioning free market. If you don't have clearly delineated, distinctions, and some people are member of the nation state and other people aren't, and the people are get to vote, and the people aren't don't get to vote, and you can choose who you're going to let in and all that kind of thing. If you don't have that, you don't have a functioning democracy. But, of course, the fact is the way politics are moving right now, the professional politicians don't want a functioning democracy. They're just part of the big managerial state. They all get together and collectively decide what they want to do, and then they do it, regardless of what the people as a whole want.
Well, I mean, that's been a movement going all the way back to the Garden of Eden. I mean, this is what the communist movement was about. This is what the Nazi movement was about. This idea of turning the world into a one world ad colony, you know, where everything operates in tune with nature or whatever that is, as opposed to democratic approach, you know, where government is basically a reflection of our values locally, it leaves us to be, to create our own personal net colonies. we're not all fused at the hip. And this is something that is completely contradicting the establishment. But they've had such an ability to control the public argument. They've had such a they didn't expect somebody like Trump to come along. I mean, I didn't either.
No.
I mean, we would actually step up and say no.
I think that's why this whole all right phenomenon is so interesting, because it's something that's come into existence outside of the mainstream media. I mean, it's deliberately opposed to mainstream media. It depends on social media and websites like pdare.com and things which are just not controlled by the establishment. The media's lost its gatekeeping function. You know, ideas are spreading through the population, which they've not vetted first. And they really hate that. But curious enough, Chuck, their response is simply to get more hysterical. I mean, I've never seen partisan coverage of a presidential candidate like this. I mean, the mainstream media is openly adversarial to Trump, and I've never seen that. It was somewhat similar in the Goldwater campaign, but never on this scale.
I agree. Okay, my guest is Peter Brimelow, he's the editor of Be Dare. He's a major conservative intellectual. He's the author of many books available at Amazon.com. Put his name in the server and up they come. Peter, I agree. I've never seen anything like the media. I listen to the usual suspects, MSNBC in particular. I mean, they're openly, unabashedly, trying to stop and destroy Trump, and they'll tell you that. And they're willing to lie to a degree that I've never seen. I mean, they always lie. That's what the left always has to lie. Otherwise, their whole structure is going to disintegrate. And they do so almost, I don't even know if they're even conscious of the fact that they lie. They can tell two completely opposite ideas in the same sentence if they're skillful at it. But the lying in this case is so blatant. And it's like I can't believe it. I mean, the lies by omission, and outright lies about Trump. And, of course, the main theme, and the one that I think is their main approach, and they'll admit this, and they said it early on, is to try to claim that Donald Trump has something against black men and women. He has something against people based on their ethnicity, and they've set this up. They'll bring out these quotes out of context, and they'll say, you see, this is evidence that he doesn't like black people, when it's obviously a big lie. I mean, anyone who knows anything about Trump knows that he doesn't care about someone's ethnic. I've never seen anyone who's less concerned with race or ethnic background. He's interested in success. He promotes people based upon how good they are. And that includes men and women. I mean, he doesn't care if it's a woman. He wants to have people who are achievers. He wants to be around people who are, you know, who reflect his value of trying to strive to be better. Not, he doesn't care about their situation of birth. I mean, this is a lie. I mean, this whole
idea, and yet they are
inculcating it.
Yeah, I think part of the problem the Democrats have got is that they're holding together a very diverse coalition, you know, blacks, Hispanics, to a certain extent Asians, left, liberal whites, and so on, who actually don't have all that much in common, don't really get on all that well. And the only way they can, as you can see by, you know, there's constant stories of schoolyard brawls and so on in between Hispanics and blacks in California. And there's hundreds of these stories. Well, the only way they can hold them together is by whipping them up into a frenzy of excitement and denouncing basically white Americans as being racist. You know, they've got to keep them at a high level of excitement and hysteria. And that's what explains, I think, this extraordinary phenomenon, these stories like Trayvon Martin and Ferguson and Black Lives Matter and so on, all of which are based on no evidence at all. But nevertheless, the mainstream media keep them going because they know they've got to, you know, stir up minority turnout. I think it's a very conscious thing. And the curious thing is, you know, that you can go back into the 2012 election. They were saying all this stuff about Romney too, that he was the secret white supremacist and so on. Obviously, utterly absurd. The only thing is they're saying it louder with Trump because they're more frightened of him.
Well, I mean, I think with Romney, the main area of attack was that he was successful. They didn't like him. We should be angry at him because he made money. You know, putting aside the fact that in 2004, John Kerry was three times richer than Romney, and he made his money from his second wife's first husband's trust fund. You know, Romney earned it the old-fashioned way, but we're to view this as bad. And they were successful at that. People sat around the kitchen table, and they were stirred up like, oh, look at how rich he is. He has more than I have. I'm jealous. Therefore, I don't like him, and I'm mad at him. You know, it's kind of like organized, you know, resentment and envy. In the case of Trump, they try to do it by saying that he's against various ethnic groups, which not only galvanizes the support of those ethnic groups out of emotion, but also, you know, generates big support among the liberal core who actually do believe that conservatives or anyone who doesn't genuflect to the left is racist. I mean, they actually believe this. I've seen it.
Yeah, they do. They do believe that. That's right. They do believe that. But you know, the story of the Romney election really was, you know, they didn't do exit polls in some of the key states, but he seems to have gotten around 57-58% of the white vote. But white turnout was sharply down. And white turnout was down the previous election when McCain ran. I mean, the Republicans are not mobilizing their white base. And what Trump is doing, of course, is he's getting white voters to the polls who haven't voted for 20 years, you know, the Reagan Democrats. The problem he also has these never-Trumpers who are basically Republican operatives
ridiculous.
Trump is the spectre of death itself, of course, because all their jobs and everything depend on being able to control the Republican Party. And so that's why you get National Review in this extremely hysterical mode against him.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the never-Trumpers are motivated by snobbery. They are used to – they have the phony British accent just like the Democrats.
Right.
You know,
right,
they travel in the fancy boardrooms and the parties and the cocktail parties. They don't want to be you know, they'd like to see their name in the paper. They don't want to be insulted. You know, these are people who want to be liked. To stick up for Trump takes social risks.
Exactly. That's a very big problem for them inside the Beltway and so on. Somebody said once that every great movement starts as a cause and becomes a business and ends up being a racket. And I'm afraid that's true for the American conservative movement, you know, which I've been involved with since 1972. I worked for John Ashbrook, Ashbrook against Richard Nixon.
Ashbrook, yeah.
But I got so you see how old I am. It was a great thing, and it did great things. And I think the likes of Ronald Reagan. I'm not one of these people who think he didn't do everything. I think he did some wonderful things. But you know that was then, and this is now. We have a whole new range of problems now.
Exactly. I mean, Trump is dealing with the issues of today. Reagan dealt quite vigorously with the issues of his time, and we should remember how much he was despised and how much he was vilified by the establishment, and how only after, I remember only after he had Alzheimer's disease did they talk about how great he was, you know, because he was no longer a threat.
If you remember, John Anderson, who was a liberal Republican, actually ran against Reagan in 1980 and got over 5% of the vote. I mean, there was a lot of resistance in the Republican establishment to Reagan, very, very serious resistance. They were very upset by him. This idea that he was great unifier, so that's only happened since he left office. You know, he seems much better to them in retrospect than he did in prospect.
No, absolutely. And I think that, who knows? We can't know what's going to happen. It'll still be a miracle. But I do think there's evidence that Trump is galvanizing his vote. They show that Republican registration in the swing states is up, whereas Democrats are flat. And that's mostly white middle class. But I also think that he is going to peel off a percentage of the black vote, of the Hispanic vote, of the Jewish vote, of the ethnic vote. I really believe that, and I've seen it. Maybe my evidence is anecdotal, but it's out there. It's rumbling in the corners because they also want to assert national sovereignty. I mean, we have the situation. Obama has brought in 10,000 Syrian refugees, and Hillary is going to be has openly stated that she wants to bring in 500,000. Now, I'm sorry, but this, there's a war going on right now. I mean, it was just 2 days ago that a woman in a burqa blew herself up in Turkey, killing 27 people. Now, if people don't think that can happen here, they've got to have their head examined.
Well, of course, it has happened here. I mean, look at the killing in San Bernardino, or for that matter, in Florida this last summer. It's quite astonishing how the mainstream media has the ability to just sort of put those things down the memory hole. You just never hear it referred to anymore, you know. It's just as if it had never happened. But it couldn't be more devastating to their case. I think really what needs to happen and what people haven't been looking at sufficiently is Hillary is saying that she's moved very far to the left on immigration. She says that she's going to get what they call comprehensive immigration reform, which is, of course, just amnesty plus an immigration surge through in the first 100 days of her administration. I mean, the political elite has been trying to get this amnesty through for 15 years, and it's been stopped repeatedly by just massive grassroots opposition. And that's what's, if this becomes if this election becomes a referendum on amnesty, Hillary's going to lose overwhelmingly.
No, I mean, it's they're playing the same old playbook. It's like they're stuck in it. And I don't think they know quite what else to do. Maybe it'll work for them. I mean, she certainly has the big money behind her. She's got Wall Street.
Right.
She's got George Soros. She's even got the Koch brothers, apparently. I mean, this is, they're all, trying to pull her over the finish line, even if she's, practically in a coma. They don't care. They want to pull her over the finish line, and they're going to do whatever they need to do that. I just think that Donald Trump had better watch his back.
You mean literally or metaphorically?
No. Peter, let me know where people can read your articles and get your books.
Well, the site is called vdare.com. It's named after Virginia Dare, who was the first English child born in the New World. She was born in the Lost Colony on Roanoke Island in 1587. So it's vdare.com. And I have books on very different subjects, Chuck. You know, I have a book on Canadian politics and on education economics and that kind of thing. But the main book I did was called Alien Nation, and it came out in 1995. And we've just made it available as a Kindle. And it's really quite parallel to Ann Coulter's wonderful book, Adios America, which I think very highly up. It comes to exactly the same conclusions. It's just that it's 20 years later now, and the situation has gotten a lot worse.
Well, you know, you unabashedly and openly promote American culture and, you know, sort of Judeo-Christian values, Western culture.
Right.
I'm not sure I agree with 100% of it, but you know, you're on the money
We run VDare as a forum site. You know, I don't regard it as a conservative site, and it's certainly not a white nationalist site. I have people on the site writing for me of all political persuasions who are concerned about immigration. And immigration, the concern about immigration does go across the political spectrum. You can find Democrats who are worried about it. I have Democratic writers. It's just that they can't speak up, because the discipline in that community is so intense. You know, they've really got to toe the line. As Sanders himself found when he said, you know, open borders is a Koch brothers policy. He was immediately tapped by all kinds of left-wing newspapers for saying that. And he told the line. He went back to saying he was in favor of amnesty and so on. So, you know, I have people from right across the spectrum, and they do disagree with each other. It's like herding cats, actually. That's why we only write on the immigration issue, because I have people in favor of abortion, people against abortion. I have people who are in favor of the wars in the Middle East, people against the wars in the Middle East. But they're all concerned about immigration, and that's the common thread.
Well, you know, Peter, it's in a way what you're describing is typical of conservatives and libertarians and people generally who are not on the left, and that is that we generally have diversity of opinion as opposed to the left, which is very uniformal. It's very lockstep. I mean, it's all a matter of those disagreements have to do with how fast we should move towards socialism, and it's more like personality, it's not ideological.
They're intensely emotional, the left. I mean, they really do have emoting minds. I think the right is rational. You know, you can reason.
I agree. Oh, totally. Yeah. Anyway, Peter, listen, I want to thank you very much for joining me this afternoon. A really interesting talk.
Thanks for having me, Chuck. Keep in touch.
All right. Thanks a lot, Peter. Take care.
Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye. All right, so Peter Brimelow has been my guest here. He's the editor of VDare, America's foremost authority on the issue of immigration, often referred to as a major leader of the alt-right movement, which is basically a younger conservative and libertarian groups. I think that Andrew Breitbart comes to mind, who is a great rhetorician. I would say that Ann Coulter is in that camp as well. In a sense, they are doing what the left always does, and which conservatives have never been allowed to do, which is satire, you know, which is they like to mock and they like to scorn, like what you see on the left. I mean, you know, in all those talk shows at night. I mean, what's his name? John Stewart comes to mind. You know, that standard. Oh, they think that's funny, but when a conservative does it, or someone who's not on the left does it, they're alt right. You know, they must have something against someone based on their ethnicity, or they throw out these kinds of charges. And I think Peter Brimelow makes the point quite well that, generally speaking, people that are not on the left are very much free thinkers. They're seekers of truth. They are very diverse in the real sense of their beliefs, their ideology, but they hold certain truths, as Jefferson might have said, self-evident. And those include the right to freedom, the right to national sovereignty, the right to control our own lives and our own destinies so that we can disagree. And the best means to do that is a system of nation states and law and order and moral values that are immutable and that are outside of the ability of powerful people to manipulate. Anyway, I also want to take a brief moment to mention my books. Why not? This is my show. What the heck? My books are available at Amazon, Amazon Kindle. Just put my name in the server, Chuck Morse, M-O-R-S-E, like Morse code, and you shall see them all come up. My latest book is Communism is Not Dead, the Communist Conspiracy in the 21st Century. I have an article I just submitted to WorldNet Daily that they'll probably publish. They usually publish my articles. I don't write them often. But this one I think was sort of a revelation to me. I say Black Lives Matter should be protesting the left, which, of course, if they really want to get to the incubus that has hurt the black community over these many decades, they would do just that. So I make that point in my article. And again, I want to thank you all for listening this afternoon. I want to again thank Peter Brimelow for joining me, editor at VDare. Thanks so much, everybody. Have a nice day, everybody.